What's up, OUXers? Today we're going to be talking to a UX lead who's been applying OUX to the e-commerce world for years. Camille Van Buren is a digital experience team lead at IKEA with a focus on IKEA's coworker experience, basically the employee experience, all that inventory and logistics and behind the scenes complexity. So today we are going underneath the cart button. Camille and I tweeted back and forth for years, exchanged a few emails, and he is currently enrolled in the self-paced OUX masterclass, but this is the first time we actually get to sit down for an extended period of time, talk face-to-face and one-on-one, and we just nerd out. I'm so excited to share this conversation. We talk about the big ideas, and then we go down into the weeds on UI implementations, on how you filter an object, a list of objects, by another object. So we get into it. If you want to discuss this episode, ask Camille more questions, basically continue the conversation, which is kind of a limitation of podcasts usually, but we fix that. Go ahead and head over to forum.oux.com and check out the bulletin board. You'll find that in the sidebar for a post on this episode where you can throw your comments and your questions in there. If you're listening a whole lot later on and it's not at the top of the bulletin board and it's been pushed down, just do a search. We'll also put a link in the show notes to get you there. This is absolutely free to make an account within the OUX forum, and you're going to find so many other goodies there as well. So before we get started, I do want to congratulate our latest certified strategist and share a few tidbits about their experience in cohort 8 of the OUX masterclass. A big congratulations to Richard, Maya, Alex, Stone, Molly, Amber, Jackie, Gina, Pauline, Andrew, Jenna, Ricky, Kate, Kevin, Charlie, Sarah, Nyong, and Akshat. And a very special, very, very special congratulations to our recertifying OUX strategists, Mike, Sandra, Carolyn, Lauren, and John. Thank y'all so much for being such an amazing part of Cohort 8. And just a few little tidbits from the stories from some of the folks that went through this experience. So Maya said that this is the missing piece to the UX puzzle. Stone said that he would recommend this program to any designer who is looking to step up their game. Molly said the OUX Masterclass certification was one of the best things she'd ever done to further her growth. Amber said that she took the OUX masterclass in hopes of finding a new, refreshing, and innovative way of thinking about design, and that it did not disappoint. She said that she'd attended other UX trainings and taken other courses, but, quote, nothing compares to the OUX masterclass. Thank you so much for those amazing testimonials. Oh, I've got one more that I really want to read. Sarah said, there is nothing out there that provides more value than this course. So you can read those full testimonials. They're actually much longer than that. You can go to oux.com/testimonials and see those stories there. Congrats. Y'all did an incredibly hard thing. And I know all those people are celebrating that massive accomplishment.
Our next cohort is set to start October 9th, 2023. But if you don't want to wait that long to get started and to start preparing, if you're super excited about joining a future cohort, go ahead and enroll in the self-paced OUX masterclass and get access to all 22 hours of the video content, all the templates, all the resources, the OUX Masterclass Concierge, which leads you through all 16 assignments, and also you're going to unlock more spaces in the forum. You're going to get bi-monthly Q&A calls with me, and you're going to get all of this, the community, the templates, the lessons, all for just under $1,000. Then, if you want to join a certification cohort, either Cohort 9 or maybe one in 2024, all you're going to do is pay the difference to upgrade to that high-touch premium experience. If you have any questions, DM me over in the forum, and I will be happy to answer your questions.
So one other thing before we jump into the episode, quick correction from a recent episode with Ali Ofisher. I referred to the workshop that we ran together for the Church of Latter-day Saints. Their correct name is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So I did want to make sure to get that right.
Okay, let's go talk about OUX and e-commerce with Camille.
Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on,
gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of object-oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it.
Camille, welcome to the OUX podcast.
Thank you.
It's great to have you this is the first time we've gotten a chance to talk one-on-one, even though I feel like we've been having a conversation for about 5 years now. Maybe even longer than that. So I think we were originally Twitter friends. And we had lots of back and forth in Twitter. And then that kind of, we had emails going back and forth, and I was getting ready for the podcast. I was like, wow, we've been talking for a while.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's great to kind of be here face to face, one-on-one, with some time to just nerd out and get into OUX. So, let's back up. You have 10 years plus in UX for e-commerce specifically. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you got into UX for e-com, how you got into OUX, and how you've kind of been merging those together? I know that's three questions in one, but you can just get us up to speed.
I'll start at the beginning and even start a little bit earlier, because I kind of rolled into UX without knowing. I think I'm of that generation that kind of rolled into UX without knowing that you're doing UX. So I started fumbling around with HTML in 1999 and just started building websites and thingies and stuff, and then kind of worked at the university where I also studied and built some websites there. And then suddenly I found myself doing UX at a consultancy company, and then suddenly realizing I was doing UX. And from that consultancy company, at some point I jumped over into first into conversion rate optimization with an e-commerce, with a large retailer here in the Netherlands. And then
rate optimization, what year was that?
That was in 2012.
Okay, cool.
Yes. Right. So I actually kind of moved from consultancy UX into conversion rate optimization expert, but then expanding from that again. I found it a bit too narrow to stay on only the A/B testing. I found it a bit boring at some point, actually. So I kind of expanded naturally again back into qualitative research, combining that to create hypotheses, but also to do a little bit more of UI design. So I tended to do quite a lot of things around UX. Spent seven or eight years at that that web shop in the Netherlands. And then actually moved into a bike manufacturer group where I was working on their e-commerce platform. And they're really applying object-oriented UX because I ran into the right people, to put it that way, who saw the value of that. So that was your first question, I think. What was your second question again?
Well, I have so many more follow-up questions to that. But how did you come across OUX, and kind of what were your first impressions? What were you hoping it would help you specifically, I guess, in the work that you were doing? So that was when you were at, I guess, the Excel group.
No, when I ran into object-oriented UX, it was in 2015. I think that was your original article on List Apart.
Yes, the dinosaur article.
That one, yeah. But in 2015, I ran into that, and I'm not sure if I was really consciously thinking about what it would solve for me. It was more a click about the thoughts behind it and the rationale behind it. And it felt kind of like, this is how I think, but you gave it a name, and you gave it a way of thinking about and a way of talking about it. And I was actually listening to one of the episodes this morning about Trello, and I think I heard the people there saying the exact same thing. Yeah. So it's more like, you know, you feel like, oh, this person thinks like me and has put the right words to it. So that's what happened to me at that time. So I wouldn't really say that I was consciously thinking about the problems it would solve for me. It was more like, hey, this is interesting. I wanna follow this. And then I think over the years, as I also grew more senior, I saw the problems it was solving, while doing it, and how it could bring value to collaboration, to consistent interfaces and stuff. I think a lot of listeners will know what I'm talking about. So that realization that it has this huge benefit actually just came later, to be honest.
And one thing you mentioned specifically with the bike company, So this was Excel was doing, it was white labeling e-commerce shops for various bike brands. Is that
exactly
correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So much good stuff there. and you mentioned in one of our emails that like that was actually helping you, that OAUX was a great way to help you interface with the developers in particular.
Also,
yeah.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what did that look like? How did OAUX help you kind of bring you together with the developers in that situation?
Yeah. So first of all, I was lucky with moving to that bike brand or to that bike group, because all the ideas that I had been gathering, thinking about object-oriented UX and e-commerce, I had gathered them for 7-8 years at my previous job, but where the train was already running. So it was harder to, move that into a running business that's already making money. And then moving to the bike brand, it was very much a clean slate, right? So they were starting a central digital team that would be building this white label e-commerce platform. And that was just, go ahead, guys. Here's a team. Here's some developers. Here's a product owner. Here's a concept manager. And go for it. And specifically, it started out actually with working with a content manager who saw the benefits straight away. We became OAUX friends. We're kind of still relatively in touch every now and then. And so we started collaborating on that. We saw the possibilities of combining a content repository with the ideas of object-oriented UX. I mean, they're very much interrelated, of course. Mm-hmm. And, not storing stuff in pages anymore, but really thinking about the data model and the content model. Because our challenge, of course, was to build something that would scale across all these different bike brands, basically turn on a new web shop, and in some cases also reuse information across all those bike brands. So there were, scalability benefits all over. So that's how it started with the content manager, who later turned product owner. Look at me, no convincing of the product owner anymore.
Yeah.
And, but I was also lucky, to be honest, to work with engineers, developers who were very much open to this approach. Because I've noticed over the years that can differ a little bit with the background of the developer or the engineer. And these guys were really open to it. And it ended up actually being that we synced the naming of our components between our design files and actually the components in the code, meaning that we would really have the same language talking about these things and having a certain convention in the namings of the components in React and the components in Sketch over there.
But what I'm hearing is your naming convention from a design perspective, from a development perspective, and from a user-facing perspective as well? Was that also aligned?
The coding names and the design names or the design component names, but also the content model names, by the way. So those three were in sync. It wasn't necessarily the exact same wording as we would be using user-facing, but it very much was connected, yes. I mean, the names we used internally were very much, kind of technically techish names that you would not necessarily represent to the user directly, but it would inform a future developer about, what he or she could expect on the front end. Yes, definitely.
So thought went into that on how to connect the language of the user, the language of the designer, and the language of the developer.
Yeah.
What a concept.
So, yeah, it was amazing, to be honest. So, and I since Can I was working imagine? With the content since I was working with the content manager as a product owner, we would actually be sitting down together in a headless content management system, creating the data models there for the different objects, naming them using those names in the design files and using those names in the code as well at some point. Yeah.
So I'm really glad you listened to that Trello episode, because I think that there's something similar here. I'm wondering if there's something similar, because one thing we were talking about, and that I think it was that the last episode, the most newest episode?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. There'll probably be another episode between us, us in this one, but the Trello episode, Atlassian episode with Caitlin and Liam. So they were talking about the interesting challenge of not necessarily white labeling, but you're basically OUXing a thing that you mm-hmm. want. The users are creating a bunch of content, and then you need to make yep. it OUXy for them to create it. An OUX in the user experience. So your mm-hmm. customers were these bike brands, right? And then their customers yes. were the bike buyers.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So what kind of interesting challenges did that make where you're creating a system that basically gets the entire system gets instantiated for yes. for a bike brand? And then they have to then do, I'm guessing, a bunch of we talked about configuration versus customization. So like they're doing mm-hmm. a lot of that as well, where they're actually going in and they potentially might be have the ability to rename objects or anything like that. Did yeah, you have that?
Yeah. 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 We again, lucky enough, because we were working, I was working with a product owner and content manager together in that content management system. We were able to give an object, let's call it an internal name or an internal identifier. Or an instance of that object, but then also give it an external name. So an example that I can think of is that bike brands often have ranges, like a family, for example, a family of bikes that share a common design element, for example. You know, there was also a sports brand that had racing bikes for 20 years, you know, the whole heritage of a certain family still going on for 20 years. So one bike brand would call this range, other one would call it a family, the other one would call it a series.
So, or a line, product line, I think.
Product line. Oh, I think internally, yeah, I remember it correctly. Internally, we called it product line. And then we made the option to translate that between quotes into something that meant something to that bike brand and their users. You know, a bike brand that has that product line for 20 years and always has communicated about it as being a family, if you suddenly force that brand to switch to product line, then they mm-hmm. won't be happy, of course, and I can understand why, and their users will be their customers will be confused as well. So we made that possible. I think the challenging part was explaining that concept, that when they would see product line somewhere, for example, explaining, no, but hang on, you can actually change that. So I think the challenging part was onboarding the different brands to this concept, but also the concept of uniformity, because we, of course, would have one data model mm-hmm. and one specific set of objects for all the brands. Yeah. Whereas there would, of course, be the opportunity for a specific brand to say, we really also need this object, and we could then introduce it and make it available for the other brands as well. That is possible. Mm-hmm. But I guess for some brands, it felt quite restrictive. It felt like this doesn't fit our identity or our thing. So we had quite some discussions around that. So that's the dynamics or the tension between the scalability part of it also. You know, with a team of 15 trying to scale that to 20 bike brands in Europe, that's a little bit of a challenge. So if you work with too many exceptions, that's going to be a thing later on. Yeah. And having that on one side and having the specific bike brands wanting their own specific thing on the other hand, that was the tension where we would get caught sometimes.
Did you actually have a user interface for them to do this configuration themselves? I forget which way Caitlin described configuration versus customization. Do you remember?
No, not exactly.
Not exact
difference.
I actually did re-listen to that episode because it was so good. But so basically, did you have an interface for them to go and change their names, or was that something like in onboarding, you had a set of salespeople that then they were doing that to create this instantiation of this entire site? Or was it was it white glove or was it self-serve?
It was a little bit of a mix of that. And I think the biggest learning there is also that we have not spent enough time at that time. I'm talking in the past because I'm not there anymore, but on onboarding the bike brands with doing that. Where they could the interface where they were working in was in the headless CMS. So we were working with a specific headless CMS, and they could just go in there and fix that. But I think the challenge there is that, yeah, what I just mentioned, I think that we could have spent more time on helping them with that and supporting them with that also.
Yeah, it's a really interesting challenge. And so Mighty Networks is what we use for the OAUX forum. And they have, I mean, you're creating your own social network. So I instantiate the network object, and then I can go in and all the objects inside of the network object, people, I can't rename spaces, but people and specifically roles, I can go in there and rename, but it's a little bit of a clusterfuck. Like, it's just, I mean, they've done, I think that there's no real good patterns for this, but it is interesting how when I go and I rename something, like for example, in an online course, I can go in there and change the name of, instead of lessons, I can call them chapters or something like that, or I can give them a completely custom name. So they have a couple pre-filled ones that I just decided, it's like, what are the things called in this online course? Do you want to call them lessons? Do you want to call them chapters? Do you want to call them assignments? Or do you want to call them your own? And if I call them my own, I have to configure it in that I have to do the singular version. I have to do the infinitive version so that they can actually, that the grammar works in all the different contexts that the system might talk to the end users. But it's interesting for anybody that's creating software where it has this, I don't know, what is the word for that? White label? It's not really white labeling, because where the end user is almost creating their own system.
Yeah, for me, the best word that comes to mind is configuring somehow. But I agree that maybe doesn't cover it completely. But
yeah, I mean, Trello is very is similar in that, but you can't rename the stuff. But you're like creating your own system within it. So the problem that Caitlin and Liam were having, where with I think this was on Liam's project, but where you would have projects being instantiated, and within the project you can rename it, but then people are hopping from project to project, and you end up with these shape-shifting labels. So you end up with all these user experience problems. So it's like, how do we give people that flexibility without letting them, and that's actually I got around to articulating it. The problem with what Mighty Networks has done is, if anybody is creating a network and they're not a UX designer and they're not an OAUX designer, they're not actually thinking about this and thinking of the labeling, they can create a massive, massive UX fail by just being able to rename stuff like this and having that level of power. Like, power with power creates responsibility.
Exactly. Well, I was while you were talking, I was thinking about it, that, you know, that's what I meant also with the onboarding that I mentioned earlier, is that, you know, we are nerds and we like doing this. So we like spending time on it, and we like also figuring out how it works and wrapping our heads around it. But our clients at that time were the bike brands. You know, what do they want to do? They want to sell bikes. You know, in the end, they don't, it's a bit maybe rough to put it that way, but they don't care about the whole system. They just want to have it work. So, you know, helping them understand that and not destroy your whole system that you've just built, but also getting them out of older mindsets, in that sense that a lot of people there would be thinking in pages. You know, I have a new release of a bike, I'll create a campaign page around it. Meaning that you cannot reuse that content anywhere else because it's stored in that page, you know, that old CMS thing page. So we were, going back to the series example, for example, if you have a well-working series detail page, then you can create a whole history. You can create an amazing landing page for that series. You know, also SEO-wise, that it can gather authority for years because it's there, and it's just refreshing every year when there are new models. And, you know, on the top that you have the new models, and at the bottom you have the older models. You can go back into history and everything. So it has amazing potential. But it
and
has
then
to be
all
used.
Your series pages look the same too, and work the
also
same.
That,
and they have this template. So when somebody jumps from series to series, they kind of already understand how the series, quote unquote, air quotes, page works.
For example, but also you have a series filter on a bike listing page, and people want to know something about the series. Well, you know, you can give them an entrance to go to the series detail page. But, you know, so there's all kinds of possibilities, and I can see your eyes twinkling, so you see it as well. But you then also have to take the people who will use it in the end in that thinking and in that idea, where, you know, from their point of view, I just want to have a campaign for this new bike that's out. Let me get it online. Where is it? And I get that. It's just then you have to work hard to make the, you know, the scalability thing do its work. And you can't trust that it'll run on its own. Yeah,
that's a challenge. So many things here. One is broader that I want to bring up, and that's so interesting that you know that your customers are coming in. These we need to get to IKEA soon too.
Well, at some point,
there's so much good stuff right here. That when these bike brands are coming in, you know, they're thinking in pages, right? And it's so interesting that we've done this to ourselves. We have made them think in pages. Like, actually, yes. It'd be so much more natural for them to think in the things. And that is our natural inclination. You know, everybody that listens to me knows that I truly believe that people think in objects, and that is our natural inclination. But somehow we've trained customers in this situation, stakeholders, POs, we've trained them to look at screens. We've trained them to think about pages. And we're like, we've made this bed that we're just like tossing and turning in, and that we need to get out of somehow to bring people back to this natural inclination to no. Before we start thinking in screens and pages, let's think about the actual concepts, the real concepts that you're actually, when you walk into a bike store, right? When you walk into a bike store, what do you see? You see bikes, you see product lines, you have orders that come in, you have customers, like those are the things in their world, but they've been trained somehow to think in these pages.
If you look at it in a larger scope, you know, when TV was introduced, what were people doing? They were making radio on TV, right? Mm-hmm. So there's always this transition from medium to new medium. And I think what naturally happened when we were, the internet started, which is, maybe not quite long ago, but it still feels like not so long ago to me.
Yeah.
What were we doing? We were looking for the closest metaphor. You know, what did we know? Pages. So that's what happened. And it grew like that. And now it's really hard to get away from it because this medium has the opportunity to not stick to that old metaphor anymore, but it's hard to get away from. Yeah, I agree.
It's so true. Yeah, we were going and we were just taking, and it was a lot of, library science, there was the information architecture movement, right, of websites, but then there was the usability movement of ergonomics from actually industrial design coming through. The history is really interesting. Like, how did we get here? And I have a hypothesis that I've spewed out into the world quite a few times. This is what I think happened on why we actually, one reason we think so verb oriented. So just being page oriented, that's one thing. But we also, as UXers, are very verb and flow oriented. And there is this big resistance to like, think about the things that people are doing the verbs to, and kind of balancing it out, right? And I'll say again for everybody listening, I don't think objects are more important. The nouns are not more important. At the end of the day, the verbs are actually more important because people got to get stuff done, but we can make the verbs so much more intuitive if we're really clear on the objects that are being acted on and like, what do I have in this environment? What can I do to these objects? Anyway, I have this hypothesis about e-commerce and that e-commerce, mm-hmm. and I just want to know, like, if you sense this or if you have any, and you can disagree with me, okay, just because we're on the OUX podcast, you can always disagree.
Let's see.
But my theory is we became so flow and verb oriented because usability testing and then UX design kind of in the early days, usability testing and UX design were sort of really tightly glommed together, mm-hmm. really got on the map and became very sort of got a seat, not really got a seat at the table, but got the money to do it because we were analyzing those conversions. That's why I asked you about what date. We were analyzing with e-commerce, especially, I'm thinking like 1999, 2000, 2001, the web 2.0 really started and really got going with people buying stuff on the internet. There was social media, but that came a little bit later. It was people were buying stuff on the internet and we wanted to make sure that they could convert. We wanted to make sure that they could get from step A to step B. So it was a lot of these flows. Can they get their credit card information in? Do they go from point A to point B? And that's where usability testing really like we could show such clear ROI when it was, we were usability testing a payment flow. And then that payment flow, we were like, oh, this is great. We can test these other flows. We can test these other conversions. And we just got this, we got a mental model, if you will, of user flows and task flows.
Yeah, I get your reasoning. I also think I related to what I mentioned earlier, the idea that we were looking for metaphors, you know, going from this page-oriented world, let's put it that way, to this new thing where we had something that looked like a page as well. And that the new thing there, of course, was the interaction. So I think that's also where we had to figure out how that works. So I think it also makes sense that naturally we would, that's, you know, that's the new part, right? That's where you have to figure out, yeah, this page static representation thing that we know, you know, when we look at the books, we look at newspapers, whatever, that's there. But how to make people act in this new environment and make it in such a way that they understand it, I can understand that naturally we would focus a lot on the interaction part, and then less on the system part.
Yeah. Right. And then those interactions were so much about going from page to page. Page one, page two, page three.
And then, of course, what were the most important interactions? I agree with you. That has everything to do with, in the end, then making money, which is about checkout flows and everything. So I think it's connected. Yeah.
Yeah, it's both definitely of those things. And also that linearity, we're used to that as well. We're used to, I was just saying, page one, page two, page three. That's what we're used to. I mean, we were used to this hierarchy, and like we had the idea of, I love the history of books too. Like the fact that like chapters didn't exist until, I don't know, like 1,000 years after writing. Don't quote me on that. But like chapters had to be invented. I think it was a lot of religious texts and so you could get to the right, because it was all scrolls before pages had to be invented, right? We were just against scrolls, and pages were a big, you know, it was a big innovation. The period had to be invented. Question mark had to be invented. Like that's just blows my mind. But we're so used to, like reading linearly. So pages, you go from page one, you might skip around a little bit, but this idea of hyperlinking, this hyperlinking thing, it was about going from document to document. And it was, there was really one object, which was the document object. And it was just going from one to the other and hard coding those links in. But Tim Berners-Lee was already thinking about this idea of not just doing those hard coded links. God, I'm just spewing all this history that I need to like fact check myself. But Tim Berners-Lee, when I've read Tim Berners-Lee's original ideas of the internet, I was like, oh, that's so object-oriented. Like that's kind of where he wanted it to go.
So I think, and in that sense, I think you're right that the commercial aspect, of course, of these flows and making money with it, that then of course automatically puts the focus on those things and not necessarily on the, you know, the bigger system part of things.
Yeah.
Okay, which only shows its benefit over time and not directly always. Yeah.
Before we get to IKEA, there's another like super detailed thing that you said, you were talking about filtering by line. So if I'm in a listing page of bikes, so the objects that I'm seeing are actual products, but I want to filter by a line / family / range, right? Depending on which bike manufacturer, which bike brand I'm looking at. So I want to filter by line, which is also an object. So it's an object that is acting like metadata, right?
Yeah.
And then I want to go and find out more about that line. This is a design pattern that comes up all the time, and that people ask me about it all the time. I have not gotten a good solution. What was your solution, or have you come across, I'm sure you've come across this maybe with IKEA as well, that you're filtering by an object. It's maybe like in a little drop down or something, but now I want to actually, I've seen the filter list, but I want to know more about that line. How do you navigate from a listing page of products to a detail page of line?
Yeah, good question. The options we tried at the time were, first of all, using the entrance of the actual filter, where you have the name of the filter. In this case, for a specific brand, that would say, for example, family or series, or with a little question mark behind it, and that you can then open up, where there's information about what is a series, what is a family. That's step one. But second, the option to say, I want to see all families, where you can then click on that link and you go actually to a product line listing page where you would list all the product lines. And from there, you could also go into the detail page of a specific product line. I'm going to stick to product lines, so we're on the same page. But also, of course, different entrances from maybe even top navigation or main navigation, because for some bike brands, those product lines are really the essence, the backbone of their whole collection. So that the organization of their bikes is often along those product lines as well. But also from a detail page of a product, of course, this bike brand or this bike is part of this product line. Do you want to see more of this product line? So we would also always look for multiple ways of finding an entrance to that specific product line detail page or product line listing page.
Did you ever try doing where, like, if the user does filter by, let's say, like, so an example that I use in the masterclass is this, the kind of an example that I go through is this imaginary app Species Saver, which is all about animals and their habitats and threats from different brands and helping people boycott brands that are, you know, killing the orangutans. So we have habitat as an object, which definitely, if I'm looking at a bunch of animals, if I'm looking at a bunch of species, that might be also something that I want to filter by. So it's one of those, you know, grouping or kind of container objects, right? Like, I like the word container object, that is a natural filter. So maybe it's in a dropdown or on a, so I might, let's say I filter the species by North America. Or actually that's a crappy read. Let's do the Borneo rainforest, stick with the orangutan. So we have the Borneo rainforest. So I filtered by the Borneo rainforest and now I'm seeing all the endangered species, not just the orangutan. I've played around with having, like, If I do trigger that filter of habitat, and habitat is an object, the first card that shows up is actually the habitat card. So, which is, I don't love it, because I'm on an animal listing page, but it almost kind of, like, that filter kind of pops out a Borneo rainforest card. Yeah. And then you see everything with it. And then you can actually click into the Borneo rainforest. And then you see the same set of animals, but you might see the description of the Borneo rainforest. You see also the threats of the Borneo rainforest. You see a big map of it and all the other good stuff. Have you tried anything like that, where you actually pull a card in on the listing page of a thing that you're not actually listing?
No, not in that way. But what we've tried, but that was with the other company, campaigns related to a specific category of products, for example. So we would also sell clothes. Mm-hmm. So at some point there would be a campaign related to that specific category of dresses, for example. And that's also where we try to articulate the value of having a campaign as an object as well, and not having it as a page. Because imagine having that campaign as a specific page, you wouldn't have to be placing banners on all the places where you would want to advertise that campaign. Whereas if you treat it as an object and you link it to a category as metadata, you say this is part of that category, you can then decide to dynamically pull up the information on specific category pages, for example, which is way easier, and it saves you a lot of time in creating 1,000 banners and putting them all over your website that you then also have to take down at some point. So, but I'm drifting in the topic, but we have tried with those campaigns to use them more as let's call them inline banners. So on row 3, there would be a horizontal thing that's clearly different than the rest of the product.
Yes.
To make sure that that people don't get confused. And actually,
I like
also
that, just moving it down a few rows so it's not at the very top of the page. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
if you put it on top, if you put it on top, that my fear would be that you're obstructing people from getting what they want, and then. Oh. You know, you're putting it in their face. And maybe for some users, it would be that, you know, they would be very interesting in it, but you don't want to stop the other ones that just want to go through. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hate the idea of, like, labeling something as a list of species, and then the first thing is a habitat. It's like, wait a second. But interstitching it down the page is fine, I think. And the other thing, I'm trying to think of, like, how Amazon does it for brands. And I think if they just show it as a link, so you just see, so if I'm seeing the orangutan and the orangutan has a little
card within the card for Borneo Rainforest, I can click directly into Borneo Rainforest. So you have a nested object within the card.
Within
the, and you can navigate that way. So yeah, having those multiple ways. Okay. Totally went in the weeds there. All right. So when you started at IKEA, I think like a year and a half ago or something.
Yes.
You posted on LinkedIn. You tagged me on LinkedIn and you said,
"Did I?
I'm so excited about going to IKEA. And yes, Sophia Prater, I will be taking OAUX with me." How's that working out so far?
Actually, it's evolving. Let's put it that way. So where I ended up is in IKEA is a team that focuses on coworker experience, which I found very interesting. It was actually also one of the reasons I wanted to switch, because I had been doing e-commerce for so long. I thought it was time to also switch domains a bit, domain knowledge a bit. So I ended up in the coworker experience area, focusing on internal tools, coworker facing, so not customer facing, and then within that specific coworker area, focusing on everything that's called we call it ILO and FF, but it's inventory logistics operations and fulfillment. So everything that has to do with goods coming in, goods moving around in the stores and goods or warehouses, and goods moving out. So I can go down two tracks now. I'm on crossroads. One, I can tell you a little bit more about how I'm currently applying it. Or second, I can focus a bit more on how I could see in the future it could bring value to the whole domain. So which one do you want?
Let's talk current first. And I'm also actually really interested in what kind of pushback you've gotten. Like, what's been hard about bringing OAUX? Let's start there. Like, what have you tried to do to bring OAUX to IKEA? And where has there been pushback? Where has there been challenges?
Okay. So as designers here, we are in a lot of cases, or most cases, let's call it embedded in a product team. So which is something we call PEDEX team, product engineering data and experience design. So then with one or two designers, you're in that specific team working on a specific product. And to be honest, within those teams, I was maybe also lucky with the product owners. They all saw the value of this approach. And within the product teams, also working with the engineers, it was relatively easy to apply either a light or a more heavy version of object-oriented UX. So one of the product teams earlier, I used it also to. And that's maybe my biggest learning here, is that it helps me. That's also I've been selling it a bit. It helps me gaining domain knowledge, because it's such a huge domain. You know, just goods coming in. It sounds easy, but there's so much to it.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So having object-oriented UX as an approach to, for myself first, get the domain knowledge and understand how this works. Is a big thing. So that's how I could also sell it to the product team, saying, well, if we take this approach, then I will be, you know, efficient, faster than otherwise. You know, how can I design a cog in the system if I don't know how the system works? I need to know how the system works. Otherwise, I'll design a cog that will break the system. And that worked quite well, actually. I must say that where I found it the hardest is to get it across my peer UX designers.
Right.
Yeah, I also cannot blame them, because there's a lot of frameworks, methods also flying around in here. We're quite a big organization, so it feels probably like another.
Yeah,
you know, I think it was also mentioned in the Trello episode as just another framework, another approach. Why should it be done differently again? I remember doing a presentation on it a few months ago. I think I also took it, to be honest, a little bit too much into too much detail at that time. So I scared some people away, I guess. That's also, you know, it's hard to find the middle ground between explaining it and not going into too many details, I find, at least. So to be honest, within my peers, I find it the hardest. I also remember the comment of one person saying, well, I actually prefer human-oriented UX. That, you know, that comment make me laugh, and I thought, yeah, I get what you're saying. And so I scheduled a coffee appointment and tried to explain, you know, this is why I think it's still very much human focused.
Right.
But the name also can put some people off. It's like,
it's like too techie or something like that. That it's more like, you know, oh, we're just doing this to kind of appease developers or something like that, because it's got the OO in the name. And yeah, that it's not that is I've heard that before, that it's not user centered, which it's like so opposite of the truth. That's the most user centered.
Yes.
See, but yeah, I get that. Yeah.
So I think in this case it was not even the fact that this person related it directly to engineers, you know, or object oriented programming or anything, but more like, yeah, but I want to put humans at the center of what I do and not objects. So I, from that reasoning, I get it. But I think I got the message across later with that coffee that you know, I think he nodded at the end.
Yeah.
I think we agreed.
Success.
And but right now I'm in a product team where the product owner luckily also saw the value of it big time, and I would say this is my most purest object or the UX approach I've been doing since I came across it in 2015, and I'm also documenting it in such a way that I can later on present it to my fellow designers to also say this is how I use it in my daily work to help me, and these are the benefits, and not, you know, having more the theoretical approach, but really try to make it, this is how I use it as an example. And then hopefully, you know, getting the message across a bit. Yeah.
So let's get into that. How are you using it for your own kind of getting knowledge of the domain, hopefully realizing where you have any kind of gaps in your knowledge, where you need to kind of figure out, you know, ask more questions. What does that look like now?
With the product team I'm currently working in, we started doing workshops and sessions just to figure out what the objects were. We're actually also converging or consolidating two systems in the scope of user authorization, which can get quite complicated quite easily, of course. So actually having, you know, a clear list of objects with the engineers, back-end and front-end, and with the product owner together, we made that list. We created that overview. We also decided, well, from these two systems, there are different words, but they're actually the same thing. Are they the same thing? Yes, they're the same thing. So we also kind of sketched with that an image of the future, what it will be like when those systems are consolidated. And then started mapping out. I did an Orca approach of the whole thing, where we started mapping out the relationships. Mapping out the actions, and currently working on getting that into, that's a new thing I'm trying, into a prototype. The stickies are in a prototype currently.
Nice.
To kind of explain, you know, on a detail page, we'll show this. Remember Miro where it was? This is just a screenshot of Miro.
Oh, wow. So you have the object map and then you have the prototype and you're kind of putting them side by side.
Yes, to really, really, really stay away from UI as long as possible.
Yes. Yeah. I love it. Like, I've seen a lot of, so in sketching within the masterclass, I didn't ask anybody to do this. I started just using the color coding. So basically taking the object map, and then it just kind of morphs into a little bit higher fidelity, but they've got the image on yellow, they've got the timestamp in pink, they've got their nested objects in blue. And it helps kind of show that translation of, this is the object map, it's basically a prototype of the prototype. It's a cheap,
exactly,
much cheaper and faster, and more collaborative too, because you can get non-designers in there much more easily. So interesting. So with all but, that, like, what
my can I add one more thing?
Yeah,
my goal
yeah.
there was also to because the thing I've been running into in my career a lot is the following sequence of events is give me design, and you know, you design things, panicked, there's some kind of deadline, there's design, and then everything slows completely down because backend discovers we don't even have this in. It needs to be discoped, or and then front ends talk to back end. Well, how can we get this information and stuff? Well, and I see you're nodding a bit, so I think you recognize the pattern.
Yeah.
So I also together with the product owner, really use this prototype with the Miro stickies, so no design whatsoever, also to save myself time, to inform discussions with backend and frontend to say, okay, this blue sticky here, it says, show all the users in this role. Do we have that info, yes or no? And how easy is it to get it? So will it go into the first version, yes or no? Looking at the product owner. You know, we think it's important, and backend engineering says it will take a lot of time. Let's decide together if we do it, yes or no. So really, really using it for scope.
Yes,
also.
For scope. For getting really clear on the requirements, the prioritization of what are we actually building? And if you can get sign off on that, and if you can get the nod and the okay from your stakeholders and from your developers before you go into visual design and before you go into screens, like how much, like when I hear people saying they don't have time to do this, I just think if you don't have time not to do this, if you need to save time, this is the way to go, because then you're iterating in these sticky notes and not in a bunch of UI.
Yeah, and now the engineers can start working on those things while we design the things that we actually already have. Mm-hmm. The easy ones, we start working on those, and they can start already preparing the work. So when we get there and we design it, it's actually, the information is actually there. So, I fully agree with you that it's you know, and I'm at this phase now. So you talk to me in 3 months and maybe the whole thing went to.
I do want to talk to you in 3 months for sure.
But, yeah, it also really depends. I've noticed on specifically for me, a product owner that you're working with who sees this approach, who sees the value there as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good gold nugget here is, you know, if you're getting resistance from your peers, from your UX peers, because, you know, it just feels like this extra thing, this other, you know, oh, it's another process, another. And we're all just so kind of jaded and I think burn out on that. Go to your POs. Like the PO could be one of your, you know, developers are a great audience for this. But
as
a
well,
PO
could be,
or
yeah.
a PM could be even more receptive. And I think that people don't think about that. They say like, oh, well, if the UX designers are reticent to this, like there's no way I'm going to convince, you know, I'm going to be able to convince the business person. But that's actually not the case because it's such a great, efficient way to gather requirements and get clear on scope, which that's just everybody wins with that. I'm curious on when you started mapping the relationships, how did that go? Did you do an asset object matrix? Were you more in the system modeling boxes and arrows? What did that look like? And did anything really juicy come out of that?
We used the nested object matrix because I find it simpler for myself, to be honest, to not get lost in the spaghetti indeed. But also I feel it's a bit more, it lends itself a bit better for going step by step, because you can't really, we did manage to do this in one workshop. So at some point we also went to a little bit of a hybrid model where I would create a proposal together with the PO and a fellow designer. Because I need to rectify one thing. It sounds like all my UX design peers now were not interested. That's actually not the case. One designer actually signed up for your self-paced masterclass. So there we go. And there were quite some people also interested in it. So we would create a first version and then send it off to the team and then have like 1 or 2 weeks where they could leave comments and we could discuss things. And that's at some point how we started doing that as well. So not in real life workshops, because also with distributed teams, sometimes it would be very hard to get that meeting and then it would all stall a bit. Did we get anything juicy? Well, actually, at the same time that we're doing this with my fellow UX designer in the team, we also started doing interviews with people currently using these two systems. And we discovered that with the relationships, we actually already covered a lot of wishes and needs from those users that they currently didn't have in those systems, which was simply, again, between air quotes, using some of those relationships to show indeed how many, which users are in this role. Mm-hmm. Seems like such an obvious thing, but it wasn't always there in the old systems. I wouldn't say that juicy or revolutionary in that sense. It was
confirming.
More like, oh, this makes perfect sense. It's confirming the gaps that weren't in the old systems.
Was role an object?
Yes. Yeah.
Roles got to be an object. Yeah, for sure. It can be metadata in some systems, but those complex systems, roles often an object, especially when you're creating roles. And
It's actually, what's the name again? Joint object, I think you call it. We have a user in role because
junction object,
that's the one.
Yeah.
Because users in a role can perform a specific thing, which is delegate also, which you can only do when you're in the role. So then, we came up with that.
Okay, but that's our follow-up
really
episode.
Really nerdy.
That's our follow-up episode in 3 months. We're going to get into freaking permissions and authentication. And because I did not realize that was your specific, is this a project that's going to be for the, that you're going to be working on for the next couple months, or is this So I'll be reaching out to you to follow up and see how that goes and talk more about permissions and OEUX, because I feel like there's so much more we can do here when we think about, especially when it comes to object level permissions, where it their roles are relative to an object, right?
Yeah.
So that's gets into this whole other layer. Okay. So to wrap up, let's talk about the future. I know that's just, we only have a few more minutes left. Do you have a hard stop? I feel like I ask this at the end of every episode because I always want more time. Great. Okay. I might take a couple more minutes from you. If you want to get into what you see, you said you're kind of seeing the future of OEUX at IKEA and with your role and like what you're doing. And you mentioned in an email something about working with a service designer. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So I think where I see a lot of value is how do I phrase this? So the object map, or the not the object map, but the overview of the system, the matrix, but also the object, I forgot the name, where you explain what an object does, the object guide.
The object guide, yes.
Guide, yes, that one. As a tool in onboarding, because this domain is so big. And as a new joiner, you get lost in all the different wording. I mean, it just the word order in this context can mean, from the top of my head, at least three things. So first, it could be a sales order, also called a customer order, which is, well, you guessed it, the order that a customer places. But then that one gets split up into multiple work orders, which is kind of instructions for different warehouses, for example, that's wrong. Because there's pick orders. It gets split into pick orders because those have to be picked sometimes in different warehouses. But then those pick orders are merged back into one work order, which is kind of a thing that goes into a truck that's shipped to your house. And theoretically, it could come from two warehouses. So it could be two work orders or even more, from different warehouses coming to your house, and then together they make the sales order again. So you're in your first meeting and someone talks about order, what are you going to assume? Of course you're going to assume like an order that someone placed, but depending on who you're talking to, it means a completely different thing. So having this as a knowledge base that you can go back to and refer to and learn from as a designer can be a big uplift in how fast you can get up to speed when you start here. And also it's, of course, when a lot of people think about OUX or the Orca process, it's easy to think about when you start from scratch, but in this case, that's impossible. There's a whole world out there. So just mapping out that world, having it as a one document where you can all fall back to, also with product owners, also with engineers, and, use it then as a starting point for your work and your knowledge within the domain. And next to that, I think it can help with scoping between different product teams. We have a huge amount of product teams here, and sometimes, as it happens, one product team or two product teams are working in the same problem space. So sometimes they end up solving the same problem without each other and without knowing it of each other, because it's just so big. Having the objects and the actions as kind of a where you put the line between one product or the other. Say, for example, you are all about creating, editing, and deleting work orders, for example, and you are about sending work orders, and that's where the line is. So that could also really help with with yeah, what's the English word? Demarcation or something, where
Yeah,
you know, draw
yeah.
the lines between the different products, and make sure that work is done most
Oh
efficiently.
my gosh, yes. Dividing and conquering much more strategically versus when the way that
Yes.
we do it now, which is often by page or by feature or even by, I've seen kind of section in the journey map. And the thing is the actions and the objects go all through there. So you could easily like be in two different sections in the journey map, right? But you're working on the same object and the same action and solving that problem.
Exactly, yeah. And then a concept that I had not been working that much with, to be honest, before I joined IKEA is the term business capability. So when I see lists of business capabilities, my head just goes the object in my head goes off, because it's just all those capabilities are about a combination of an object and a verb. It's always about, people planning. So it's about planning people. You know, it's all those capabilities match or cover one or more products and actions often. So linking it to the business capabilities with the objects would help us big time with distributing work of a product teams, but also prioritizing work, because it sometimes it's so hard to keep the overview. And I think that domain system model could really help us with with dividing the work and making sure that we don't do double work and not reinventing the wheel and
Oh my
stuff.
gosh. Yes, I love all of that. And I mean, as far as onboarding, that's kind of like what we were talking about before. Like this is what you are doing for yourself to onboard yourself to this complex domain. Chase Roberts talked about this on the podcast when he joined Chewy.com. He used it as a way not only to onboard the product, but also the organization. He OUX, because it's such a massive organization, he OUX the Chewy. The org chart basically, which is very hierarchical, but we usually don't work in org charts anymore. Like it's more of this web. So he OUX'd the organization to just figure out where he sat within the organization. This is the origin of OUX. This is going back to the origins. This is why I created this methodology, was because I was being dropped into really complex situations and was like, it was told that I needed to get wireframes done in 3 or 4 days. And it just having to get up to speed in these just, B2B insurance, finance. I was at the beginning of my career, I was working at Accenture. So it was a lot of B2B stuff that I was working on, and getting dropped into different projects, every couple months. So it was, I had to have a better way to get up to speed because I can't do guesswork. It's not in my personality to just design something that I don't understand. And some people can get away with that and they can do it and they can fudge it. And my gears come to a grinding halt and I say, I'm not just gonna like guess where this attribute goes if I don't understand the priority of it or what it actually does or if there's any conditional logic around it. Like, oh, or what where it shows up on other screens throughout the system that the user might be using. Like I just noped that, and so I had to figure out a way out. But yeah, seeing an object guide is a way if you have somebody new coming on the team, to be able to plop an object guide, and then all you have to do is you have to teach them to read an object map, and which can take 5 to 10 minutes. Teach them to read the object map, and then they have
There you
X-ray
go.
vision into the entire system and a CTA matrix, and
You get onboarded to your product team, they talk about order, and you can ask the question, are you talking about work order, sales order, or pick order? I don't know. They tell me.
Yeah,
No, definitely.
exactly. You end up asking better questions. You end up getting clarification in a way that actually makes you look really smart because you know that there's three different types of orders in that conversation, and it's a totally valid question to be asking.
Yeah, of course.
Let's talk real quick about, because I just, even if it's just like a pin to talk next time a little bit more on what you're thinking with OUX and service design. Because you said you were working with a service designer, which is
Yeah,
really interesting.
that's
And like, where is this going? Where you're, what's going on? How are the gears turning there?
The part about the capabilities that I mentioned, because the service
Oh,
designer I'm
okay.
working with is working a lot on trying to figure out, we have these business capabilities and which roles in the company are actually working on those business capabilities, and then mapping out which tools and sometimes overlapping tools are supporting that, but connect to that same overview, could put in the objects. So you have this capability performed by this role, and what are the objects involved in there? So that's what I meant with the service designer. So he inspired me to think a little bit broader than only, you know, the specific product that was in and the products that are there, but just the whole thing and how they connect to all the different capabilities that we have. Yeah.
I'm going to give you a little bit of homework, and unless you may have already done this, but I'm really curious to see how go with your service designer and list out the business capabilities and do a nested business capability matrix. Which, even though they're not instantiated, so you take your, what, how many business capabilities are there? Like,
I don't know from the top of my head, but it's quite a few.
Okay, take like the top 10. I like
30,
the top
40,
six.
50 or something.
Okay.
Yeah,
no, I thought those were more like main initiatives. Well, maybe take like the ones that are really hot right now. So take like the six or something, the 6 to 7, and do list them across the x-axis, list them across the y-axis, and map out how they intersect with each other.
It's a good idea. I'm going to have a look.
See how they connect. How do the business capabilities connect? Not only how do they connect with the objects, but how do they connect with each other?
To each other. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's also, yeah.
I've been playing around with that. A service or a system design, nested system matrix or something like that. So you're taking these macro systems, you're literally taking the entire Orca process and you're popping it up a level where the objects that you're working with are not instantiated objects. They're more like business initiatives or even values or something like that. You can matrixify those and you get some really interesting conversations out of it. Cool. All right. So a couple months from now, we'll loop back, see how you're doing with the authentication stuff, role as an object. We'll talk about object. I'll ask you about object relative roles. But this has been absolutely amazing. Camille, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And I've really enjoyed it. And I think our listeners are really going to enjoy it too.
Well, same here. Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Cheers. Have a great day. Happy OUX.
Yeah. You too.
Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!